The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and today it's my pleasure to welcome to the program Jeffrey Rosen. He joins us on the phone in Philadelphia. He's just published a new biography of President William Howard Taft. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
William Howard Taft, he was part of actually the beginning of a political dynasty in Cincinnati, wasn't he?
He was. I was just in Cincinnati recently. My wife is from Springfield, so we were going to the Great Taft Museum, and that was owned by his half-brother Charles. And, of course, William Howard Taft was the father of Robert Taft, who is the most influential Republican senator of the 20th century. His daughter, Helen, was a very distinguished professor of history. And his father, Alfonso Taft, was a founder of the modern Republican Party, who signed the first Republican platform in 1857. And finally, Charlie Taft, one of his sons, was the longtime mayor of Cincinnati, known as Mr. Cincinnati. So very strong Ohio roots, and it's just wonderful to talk about him.
Don't forget Governor Robert Taft, Bob Taft.
Absolutely right. Thanks for remembering him, too. He keeps the tradition going.
The dynasty continues.
Taft in 2020.
No, I think it's Kasich in 2020, actually.
Okay.
Jeffrey. What made you the person to write about William Howard Taft? I know you have an interest in the Constitution. You want to tell us about your day job, one of your day jobs?
I would love to. I have the great privilege of being the head of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, which is a wonderful education center created by the U.S. Congress to increase awareness and understanding of the Constitution among the American people. It's the only nonpartisan, nonprofit institution created by Congress devoted to constitutional education, and we bring together all perspectives to educate citizens about this wonderful document of human freedom that unites us. I'm also a law professor for a long time. I teach at George Washington Law School in Washington, D.C., so I think it was for those reasons that the editor of the American President series, which this book is part of, Sean Wilentz from Princeton, asked me to write this book because Taft was our most judicial president and presidential chief justice. And we can talk more about that in a bit. But he had such a strong interest in the Constitution that I think they thought a law professor might be a good guy to write about him.
In fact, he was a rather reluctant president, wasn't he?
He certainly was. He yearned to be on the Supreme Court. To be Chief Justice is more to be president, in my estimation, his father, Alfonso Taft, told him, and William Howard Taft enthusiastically agreed. One of his favorite jobs was serving on the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Ohio, and he agreed to be both Secretary of War and then Theodore Roosevelt's chosen successor with the greatest reluctance. Essentially, Roosevelt and Taft's wife made him run for president in 1908, even though he yearned to be on the Supreme Court. He spent 4 years as president where he approached every decision in constitutional terms, thinking like a judge, asking whether the Constitution allowed or prohibited the action. And then finally, when he lost the election of 1912, with some relief, he achieved his lifelong dream nearly 10 years later when he became the 10th Chief Justice of the United States. And if he had chafed in the White House as a judicial president, he thrived in the Supreme Court as a presidential Chief Justice.
My guest is Jeffrey Rosen. His new biography of William Howard Taft has just been published. He was a very dear friend of Theodore Roosevelt, who you mentioned. President Roosevelt preceded him in office. In fact, Taft wanted to carry through TR's agenda as president, but his presidency really led to the destruction of their relationship, didn't it?
It did. Taft was determined to put Roosevelt's activist executive orders on strong constitutional terms. Roosevelt, like recent presidents, from President Bush to President Obama to President Trump, had ruled by executive order. And Taft thought that that violated the Constitution. He thought that only Congress had the power to protect the environment, for example, or to declare war. So although he withdrew more lands for environmental conservation than Roosevelt did, and he brought more antitrust suits against monopoly than Roosevelt did, he wanted to do so on strong constitutional grounds by persuading Congress to endorse the policies. And in the end, Taft's insistence on turning to Congress led to an unfortunate rift with Roosevelt. The details are complicated, but Taft fired an environmental official who Roosevelt liked a lot, and Roosevelt took it as a personal affront. And that led to a series of events where Roosevelt decided to challenge Taft for the presidential nomination in 1912. That feud tore apart the Republican Party, divided the GOP vote, and led to the election of Woodrow Wilson, a Democrat. It initially destroyed Roosevelt and Taft's relationship, although happily they did make up later in life, where they met in a hotel and buried the hatchet.
In fact, that election, if I'm correct in my estimation, was the only one since 1860 where a member of either the Democratic or Republican Party finished in third place.
That's exactly right. Roosevelt got the most votes of any third-party candidate. Taft got the fewest electoral votes of any sitting president, only two, Utah and Vermont, and Woodrow Wilson had an electoral college landslide.
But Taft didn't care, did he? He was happy to not be president.
He was relieved, and the greatest sign of his relief was his extraordinary weight loss after the election. We think of Taft, Americans, if they think of Taft today, they often think of his large avoirdupois, as it was called in those days. He weighed 340 pounds as president. But after he lost the presidential election, with contentment and relief, he went on an extraordinary paleo diet, and he managed to lose about 76 pounds in barely more than a year. And he kept the weight off for most of the rest of his life. So for most of his career, especially his distinguished career as Chief Justice, Taft was svelte and fit, and it was only during his unhappy presidential years that he not only was large, but also had a disorder called obstructive sleep apnea, which jarred him awake every 2 minutes, making it impossible for him to sleep through the night, and as a result, he would fall asleep in public and in meetings with the Chief Justice and at the opera. But once he lost the weight, he gained his alertness and productivity, and he was remarkably fit for the rest of his life.
His overeating as president was kind of a coping mechanism then.
He definitely ate his feelings. He was very good-humored about it, and he told lots of excellent jokes on himself in his wonderful book, which I recommend to listeners, Our Chief Magistrate and His Powers, which is one of the best books on the presidency and the Constitution. Taft tells the story about how a woman came and asked Taft, when he was Secretary of War, to admit her son to West Point, despite the son's physical disabilities. And when Taft agreed, the woman was so grateful that she looked at him and blurted out, "Mr. Secretary, you're not nearly as fat as they say you are."
He was very self-deprecating. I liked his joke about the sofa.
Tell that one. That's such a good one.
It's near the end of the book. They were saying they had a chair for him. He says, "I think you'll need a sofa."
Exactly. And then the famous one when his Secretary of War, he told the Secretary of War that he'd taken a horse up to the top of the mountain on a foreign trip, and the Secretary cabled, "How is the horse?"
Let's talk about his early career that led up to being president, because he had a very interesting time in the Philippines.
He sure did. He was governor general civil governor of the Philippines at a time when the U.S. had just annexed it. And he essentially wrote the Constitution, and he thrived at a time when he could serve as a combination of chief judge and chief magistrate. He built a lot of schools, which the Filipino people were very grateful for. He did not suffer from the racial prejudice of some of his predecessors, and insisted on inviting Filipino officials to the governor's mansion, and he created a Constitution, which had many, although not all, of the rights of the U.S. Constitution, because he did take the rather, you can call it paternalistic or Madisonian view that people should only exercise constitutional rights when they're educated enough to do so. But it did have most of the rights of the U.S. Constitution. And he was such a success as civil governor that when Theodore Roosevelt tried to make him come home to be Secretary of War or to serve on the Supreme Court, there were demonstrations in front of the presidential palace saying, "Queremos Taft, we want Taft." So he stayed where he was. It was the only position which he thrived as a, in a sort of a political or administrative capacity, and he really enjoyed being governor of the Philippines.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. My guest is Jeffrey Rosen. His new biography of William Howard Taft, part of the American Presidents series, has just been published, and this is a really great series because these are quick reads. These are very concise, very pithy. You can read any one of these books in just a couple of hours. And we've had a number of authors on the program from this series. We had Robert Dallek on for Harry S. Truman, Senator George McGovern for Abe Lincoln, and Gail Collins for William Henry Harrison. And she was from Cincinnati, and she had a great anecdote from her father about how their family was connected to William Henry Harrison because her father worked for the utility company in Cincinnati, and in the middle of the night, they sent him out to raise one of the Harrison's old homes because they didn't want to be designated as a historic landmark, so they had to tear it down in the middle of the night. So she felt like she was kind of making it up to William Henry, who, of course, had a very short presidential career. Now, William Howard Taft, he's not considered to be a great president, but as we look at our current president, he looks better all the time, doesn't he?
Well, the National Constitution Center is nonpartisan, so I won't, you know, comment on the current situation, but I think it's fair to say descriptively that in terms of his approach to the presidency, President Taft was the antithesis of President Trump, because President Taft believed that the president could only do what the Constitution explicitly allowed, unlike President Roosevelt, Wilson, and most presidents since then, including the current president, who thought the president could do anything the Constitution didn't forbid. Also, Taft was an anti-populist. He believed, like the framers of the Constitution, that unchecked direct democracy would lead to demagogues and the mob. And he said repeatedly, our founders did not create a direct or pure democracy. In the election of 1912, he viewed that as a defense of the Constitution against the populist demagoguery of Roosevelt and Wilson, who endorsed things like the initiative or popular recall of judicial decisions with which the people disagreed. And Taft thought that only slow and thoughtful deliberation over time could protect the rule of law and individual rights. In this sense, he was channeling his heroes, John Marshall, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison. So really, the election of 1912 was the last one fought over whether America should be a direct democracy or more of a constitutional or representative republic. And Taft, in standing up for the framers' view, was our most constitutional president.
Hmm. He's also, at least in my reading of your book, a guy who sounds like a really nice guy. You talk about his wife and how she had a stroke shortly after he was elected president. And he is just so loving and devoted to her. He just seems like such a wonderful man.
It's a beautiful story. They fell in love when they were young. They read literature together. She was devoted to him and vice versa. And when she did have a tragic stroke after just a year in the White House, as you say, he tenderly nursed her back to health, spending hours a day teaching her to regain her speech. He was so stricken when he found out about her illness, and his last words when he himself was dying after a stroke, after a trip to back home to Ohio, was simply darling. You know, he just wanted his wife to be near him. Mm-hmm. He was an equally devoted father to his kids, and he was much admired by his closest aide, Archie Butt, who served and admired both Roosevelt and Taft. He was an extremely appealing person.
Let's talk about some of the things that he accomplished and also some of his big mistakes.
Sure. Well, his biggest accomplishment, which is relevant right now, is that he was the first Republican president of his era to lower tariffs. The Republican Party, ever since it was founded in 1857, was devoted to the protective tariff, dating back to the time of Alexander Hamilton and Lincoln, too. And Taft, along with the moderate reformers in his party, thought that protective tariffs jacked up prices for consumers and was bad for the economy as a whole. And it was a political minefield, and he wasn't successful in getting them as down as far as he hoped. But by successfully championing the Dingley tariff bill, he set the Republican Party and the Democrats down to a bipartisan consensus in favor of free trade that's more or less persisted until quite recently. So that was a big accomplishment. He was a very effective trust buster, bringing more antitrust suits than Roosevelt had. He was a great environmentalist, withdrawing more lands for environmental protection. He kept the peace. He refused to send troops over to Mexico despite the popular clamor for war, because he thought that Congress, not the president, had the power to send troops abroad. He was in favor of international arbitration treaties and managed successfully to persuade Congress to pass the Canadian Free Trade Agreement. This is the precursor of NAFTA, which was a huge achievement. Ultimately, Canadian voters refused to ratify it, but it was a remarkable achievement that, again, set the U.S. down the path toward participating in treaties from NAFTA to the World Trade Organization, all of which we're now thinking of withdrawing from. And if that weren't enough, he appointed a series of excellent justices to the Supreme Court, and he felt that he defended the rule of law by acting within his constitutional bounds. And the fact that his policies were enacted by Congress rather than by executive order led them to be continued by subsequent administrations, including the Wilson administration, which lowered tariffs further in 1913 and committed the U.S. to a series of international courts, which Taft thought was the way to maintain international peace. So really not a bad record of achievement for someone who's ranked, as you said, in the middle of our presidents. He's not considered a failure, but not a great success. He's sort of averaged around 20 or 22 in many surveys. But all of his constitutionalism as president set the stage for his amazing second act, one of the best second acts in American politics, where he became Chief Justice. And there he's widely considered to be among the best of the Chief Justices after John Marshall and Earl Warren and a handful of others, Holland Fisk Stone, Charles Evans Hughes. Taft is considered among the chief justices who were most successful because he created the modern federal judiciary as an independent branch of government. He created the administrative structure that allowed the federal governments to be strong. He built the beautiful Supreme Court building, the Temple of Justice, and he gave the Supreme Court control over its own docket, which was a tremendous power that it bears to this day.
He did have some false steps and some blunders, though. In fact, one gaffe that comes to mind is the one apparently that he made that cost that Canadian trade agreement.
Yes, he had an unfortunate habit of blurting out the truth. The journalist Michael Kinsley in the late 20th century said, in Washington, a gaffe is telling the truth. And Taft, in a letter to Roosevelt, said something like, if this trade treaty passes, then it's going to be so successful, then economically Canada will be kind of annexed to the United States. And that leaked out, infuriating populist fervor in Canada, and in a kind of anti-Brexit-like vote, the Canadian voters rejected the agreement.
You mentioned earlier that in some ways he's very different than our current president. Yet in one way, he seems to be somewhat similar in that you describe him as being thin-skinned and also prone to firing people very impulsively.
Yes, that was his Achilles heel. He was very prickly on matters of honor. When a rival insulted his father when Taft was a young man, he was so furious that he went to the rival, it was a newspaper editor actually, to his office, and pulled him up by his arms and beat his head against the ground. So he was very prickly on matters of family honor, and he made this catastrophic decision, which could be a warning to all presidents, to fire whistleblowers. First, someone in the environmental department who accused his administration of giving away environmental lands to corporate interests, and then he fired the guy's superior, Gifford Pinchot, Theodore Roosevelt's closest advisor on environmental matters. Pinchot was a self-styled martyr who made a huge fuss, and the congressional hearings looking into the firing ended up deeply embarrassing Taft because it turned out he'd backdated a memo for complicated reasons. So as usual in D.C., the cover-up is worse than the crime. Mm. His interrogator in that hearing was Louis Brandeis, one of the greatest Supreme Court justices of the 20th century. My last book was about Brandeis, and when I wrote about Brandeis, I was sort of skeptical about Taft because Brandeis wasn't a big Taft fan. But then I learned more about Taft and found out that on the Supreme Court, Brandeis and Taft reconciled. They set aside their differences. They respected each other's devotion to the institutional legitimacy of the court, and they basically made up. But Taft's firing of Gifford Pinchot is a great warning for all presidents. You know, don't fire folks without taking into account the possible political backlash.
You mentioned Charles Evans Hughes as being one of the great chief justices. He came after Taft because that Taft was a wily one, wasn't he? He never lost sight of the real prize.
He sure didn't. It's an amazing story where it's time for Taft to appoint a new chief justice while he's president, and he's going to appoint Hughes because everyone agrees that this former New York governor is a dynamo and is incredibly brilliant. And Hughes is actually dressing for a White House appointment when Taft changes his mind and calls Hughes up and says, never mind. And instead he appoints a 65-year-old Southern Democrat as Chief Justice, Edward Douglas White, who's currently on the court. The only explanation for this completely bewildering appointment is that Taft hoped that White would expire in time for Taft to take his place. And that's basically what happened. Taft waited for 10 years, and he keeps checking out White's health after he's president, and White doesn't seem to be going anywhere. But then, out of the blue and without warning, White does indeed die, and Taft then lobbies hard for the position, and he's able to take White's place. So he planned his own succession as well as he possibly could.
And he was appointed Chief Justice by President Warren Gamaliel Harding, the last president from Ohio after a long string of Ohio presidents like William McKinley, who was president, and then Theodore Roosevelt took over when he was assassinated. And he kind of kept Taft on a string, though. He was afraid that he wasn't going to follow through and appoint him.
He was. Harding invited Taft over for a jovial breakfast, and they had chipped beef, and they had pancakes, and Taft didn't know what Harding was going to say. And finally, Harding said, if I were to offer you a seat on the Supreme Court, would you take it? And Taft is really excited. He said, this is the dream of my life, that it would have to be Chief Justice. And Harding says, all right, I'll do it. But then he dithers, and Taft just gets all these people to lobby on his behalf. And finally, it turns out that it's Taft's bipartisan popularity after his presidency, driven by his embrace of international organizations like the League of Nations and also his unexpected embrace of labor rights, which he'd been suspicious of for most of his career, that wins over progressives. And he's confirmed nearly unanimously when Harding finally appoints him.
Mm. It must have been so hurtful for Taft when they had the election of 1912 and they were going into the Republican convention and Roosevelt was fighting him for the nomination. You quote Roosevelt, who was always so eminently quotable, as saying things about Taft, like calling him a puzzle wit and a fathead. And you have a quote, he's a flub-dub with a streak of the second rate and the common in him. That must have just been devastating for Taft.
Yes, it shows that the vaunted tribune of the people, Theodore Roosevelt, was an elitist at heart, but it wounded him deeply, and he was very sensitive. There are times when he realizes that Roosevelt has rejected him, and his aide found him breaking down in tears on a railway car, shaking convulsively and saying, Roosevelt was my closest friend. So it was an incredibly painful break for a tender-hearted president who took the friendship very seriously. And it was a source of great pain to Taft that he had to run against Roosevelt. But he did it because he viewed it as a defense of the Constitution. He came to believe that Roosevelt represented a threat to the rule of law and had become the kind of demagogue that the framers feared. So that was what steeled his determination. He's extremely upset about the loss, not because he liked being president, but just it was so embarrassing to lose by such a large amount, although he kind of expected it. And that's why he felt so vindicated by his appointment as Chief Justice. He says, this has returned me to the position that I was in before 1912, a real poetic justice to the career of an extremely talented man.
It's the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Jeffrey Rosen. We're talking about William Howard Taft, his new biography of the president, and his greatest accomplishments were as Supreme Court Justice. And apparently Chief Justice Roberts is a big admirer of Taft. And Taft loved having consensus opinions. They diminished somewhat as he went through his term, but he loved a consensus, didn't he?
He did, and he was so good at it. He was always best as a conciliator presiding over a judicial conference. And under his leadership, especially at the beginning of his tenure, there were very few dissenting opinions. Overwhelming majorities of the decisions were unanimous or nearly so. Taft discouraged dissents, which he said he didn't approve of. He would suppress his own dissents in the interest of unanimity. He persuaded liberal skeptics like Brandeis and Holmes to join him in majority opinions. And his model of a Supreme Court with a Chief Justice presiding over narrow unanimous opinions is one that Chief Justice Roberts embraced at the beginning of his tenure, invoking both Taft and Chief Justice Marshall, their greatest predecessor. So he was not a good popular leader as president because he forswore popular leadership. He thought that the presidency should get his authority from the Constitution, not directly from the people. But he was an extremely good leader within the confines of the court, where he could preside over a small group of equals and achieve consensus through the kind of Madisonian thoughtful deliberation that the framers had in mind.
As President and Chief Justice William Howard Taft was dying and on his deathbed, the other justices sent him a letter, and this letter brought a tear to my eye. What a different time.
It says, "We call you Chief Justice still, for we cannot give up the title by which we have known you all these later years and which you have made dear to us. We cannot let you leave us without trying to tell you how dear you have made it. You came to us from achievement in other fields and with the prestige of the illustrious place that you lately had held, and you showed us in new form your voluminous capacity for getting work done, your humor that soothed the tough places, your golden heart that brought you love from every side, and most of all from your brethren, whose tasks you have made happy and light. We grieve at your illness, but your spirit has given life an impulse that will abide whether you are with us or away."
So wonderful. That was a great way to close the book. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you for asking me to read it. It is beautiful, indeed.
My guest has been Jeffrey Rosen. His new biography of William Howard Taft just published, part of the American Presidents series, which began with the late Arthur Schlesinger Jr. And I'm sure that Arthur would be very happy with these subsequent volumes. Don't you think?
Thank you so much for having me.
For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.